Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back as we continue counting down our top 100 movies of all time. And today we are up to number 34, episode 67. We are two-thirds of the way through this craziness. And we're going to be talking about the Royal Tenenbaums from 2001. I want to call it 2001, which is just weird now. And Halloween from 1978, which John is using as a replacement for Psycho, which appears higher up on my list. Number 34, you know, we're into those movies where, like, both of us are just going to love them when we get two movies that are actually, like, a movie that's on my list and a movie that's on John's list. So that's why I think it's a little bit interesting when we do have a movie like Halloween. In a couple weeks, we have Goodfellas. A couple weeks after that, we have The Imaginarium with Dr. Parnassus. And then Interstellar and Midnight in Paris. These are the five movies left that are not actually in the top 100. And I think those episodes are a little bit interesting because even though there's going to be... I might hate Stalker. Who knows? I've never seen it. He's never seen The Deer Hunter. We could be talking on the last episode, sitting here ripping each other's favorite movies apart. But at the same time, it's like we're getting to the point where we know we love at least one of these. We're probably going to find a lot of value in the others. So when you get an episode like this where you have a Halloween, which is considered a classic, it's fun to talk about, though, because it didn't actually make our cut. And now we're getting into just the creme de la creme, if you will. So, John, why'd you pick Halloween for Psycho? And I'm not saying we're going to lead with Halloween, but why'd you pick Halloween?
There are a couple of reasons why I picked Halloween here. A lot of it had to do with Psycho is often considered like one of the first slasher movies of all time. I mean, obviously, like Peeping Tom precedes it, but it holds this place in like the horror pantheon as like one of the most important slasher films of all time. And I feel like Halloween is that point where we saw the evolution of slasher films. Something we could have put in here instead would have been like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I thought Halloween fit a little more thematically with Psycho, obviously with Janet Leigh's daughter being in it.
Yeah, well, that too. And I don't think a lot of people realize that because of everything. The reason she is Jamie Lee Curtis is Janet Lee. She spells it differently than Janet Lee does. And then Tony Curtis. Those are her parents. Yeah. So Texas Chainsaw Massacre came before this. Texas Chainsaw Massacre, though, is an interesting one because it's not the typical slasher film. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is much more of a Cabin in the Woods type film. And that might be like the definitive Cabin in the Woods type film, even though it's not a cabin in the woods. But four friends travel out into the middle of nowhere and they get murdered. Like, that's a different vibe than the Halloween's, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, that genre. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre was not for teenagers. That wasn't like a, ooh, like this is a sexy movie. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is one of the most messed up movies of all time. And for anybody who follows the guy, it's on Twitter. I don't know what his name is because I just see it every now and then when it gets retweeted because I don't actually follow him. But for like the last 500 days, he's been inserting Paddington into one still from a movie.
Yeah.
And the one he did was Texas Chainsaw Massacre with the girl all covered in blood in the back of the truck and Paddington like next to her, like screaming. It's so funny. But Texas Chainsaw Massacre wasn't supposed to be that. Halloween changed the genre. And I will say this. I will say this. I think it changed it 1,000% for the worse. Now, I don't know how you feel about that, and I'm curious to hear, but my personal preference, I do not like slasher movies really at all. I don't find them scary. I find them pretty monotonous. I like when you get a cool twist on one, like It Follows is technically a slasher film, even though there's nobody being stabbed in that movie. It's still a slasher film, but I like that it's giving a different twist than what these late 70s, 80s horror movies were, which to me, watching people get stabbed by a guy who's walking 3 miles per hour, you know, or, you know, whatever, isn't scary. That being said, I have Psycho in like my top 15, but that's a different kind of slasher film. Halloween really did start this trend of like, you know, just kids, hot people getting stabbed, sex, violence, whatever. These were your date night movies now, as opposed to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You took a girl on a date to go see Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You probably were never going to see her again. Yeah. So let's start with Halloween just because we've been talking about it. But so, John, Psycho is your number 34. You chose Halloween. What was your take on watching Halloween this time? And how does it live up, especially since we watched it in freaking July, dude? It's 101 degrees out down here in South Florida. And I'm watching Halloween on like a Saturday at 2 p.m.
Yeah, it's the first time I watched Halloween, I rated it a 4-star movie. I took it down half star this time because this movie does get very slow, and it's in like the climax of the film that I find it starts dragging, which is weird. I think the setup for this movie is phenomenal. I do enjoy it quite a lot. I do think it's very important to, you know, horror in general that this movie was made just based on what happened afterwards. Obviously, I think a lot higher on slasher films than you do. I mean, Scream's one up in my top 100. But there are, like, the formulaic slasher movies are boring. And that's why and it was the 80s when they started capitulating all of these, like, slasher sequels, that horror started dying. The entire genre started dying in the 80s. And Halloween, like you said, is to blame for that, but it's so iconic because it really helped define a lot of the genre standards we're so used to nowadays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like, go ahead.
I was just like, if you're looking at some of these things, it's like the masked villain. Like, yes, again, Texas Chainsaw Massacre had that, but like it's different in this case where it's like it's the anonymity of this character. That, like, you know who he is, you know his name, but you don't know what Michael Myers' face looks like. And that's mm-hmm. terrifying. It's that unknown there. It's the fact that Halloween brings in, it takes horror from the outskirts of society and brings it to suburbia. That's one of the biggest things that Halloween did for horror. Because horror up to this point was so much set on the outskirts of society. It was either those, like, Cabin in the Woods type movies where you're going out into the forest and stuff, or you're off on the edges of society, like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or it's
Psycho.
Like Psycho, yeah. Where you're like at this random hotel in the middle of nowhere. This isn't that. This brings the horror home to your backyard. That's what Haddonfield represents, and that's why I think this movie is so important.
Yeah, I mean, I gave this 2.5 stars. Halloween's never done it for me. I love the score to this. I think Donald Pleasance is fun for the brief moments he's in. In terms of the characters, like, don't really care. Obviously, that's not what the point of the movie is. It's kind of like The Evil Dead. Like, that's not the point. But at the same time, like, this movie could have been an hour and 10 minutes, and it would be perfection. Mm-hmm. Like, yep, it would be perfection. And I think that all of the extra, like, walking and following whoever, and really, we don't need to watch both girls die first. If you've ever seen, if you haven't seen The House of the Devil, The House of the Devil is just a slow burn, great horror movie by the guy Ty West. And it's just this slow burn, and it's got Greta Gerwig in it, and it takes so long to get where it's going. But you're finding yourself invested because it's changing locations here and there. And then by the time it does get chaotic, it is nuts. And there's that uneasiness the whole time. I think my biggest problem with Halloween is you know that the two girls that aren't Jamie Lee Curtis are going to die. Yeah. It's just, why is it taking so freaking long for Michael Myers to kill them? And I get that's part of the fun. You know, I mean, she thinks it's her boyfriend coming back in after they had sex and whatever. And we know it's Michael Myers. Ha, ha, ha. But like, why does it take so long? Like, why is what's her name not just murdered in the laundry room immediately? Like, just kill her in the laundry room. Great. Awesome. Moving on to the next one. Like, it takes so long to get going. And to me, it doesn't build suspense. It's losing the suspense. Now, I also understand 1978, people hadn't really seen something like this before. This was really new. That's a game changer for sure. But while I can appreciate this movie, it's one of those where when it's Halloween time and, you know, you're in October, what movies do you want to watch? This is never a classic that I go to. Like, I am very much somebody who will go to the old movies, go to Psycho, go to The Exorcist, maybe go to some of those newer ones, The House of the Devil, It Follows, The Babadook, things like that. Hereditary, I think, is another great one. But I'm never saying I think my internet just totally cut out. That was weird. So when did I cut out? I definitely think that just happened.
You were just saying. That was the last thing you said, was I was just saying.
I was just saying, man, I don't even know. Did I get to the part of like what movies I actually like watching or no?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Good.
Just finished listing those.
Okay, good. Well, so I never will go to these movies. I'll never go to Halloween. Mm-hmm. I'll never go to Friday the 13th. I'll never go to Nightmare on Elm Street. And Halloween is obviously light years ahead of Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. Like those two movies are, in my opinion, just like whatever. Like they're just there. Freddy Krueger's pretty cool. Jason is, I think, like the dumbest villain ever. I really don't care for that one at all. But I like this movie. I don't love this movie. This is not a movie I'm going to keep going back to. And I really just think it should have just been shorter. I mean, that's really all it needed to do. And especially with this low budget, why didn't John Carpenter just make it 70 minutes? Everybody can make a 70-minute horror movie. Why did it have to be 90? Like, it's just, it's dragged out.
Yeah, I see. I almost find the low budget aspect of it so endearing, though. I love, like, these, like, shaky cam shots from John Carpenter. Just, like, these first-person shaky cam shots. I find them endearing in this film. I find that it kind of, like, it adds this sense of menace to it, where it's like Halloween, for all intents and purposes, based on the production quality of it, should be considered some like B movie. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's surpassed that because of the legacy it's created. And yes, that legacy includes a lot of bad sequels. Mm-hmm. Some like okay sequels, but a lot of bad sequels.
Season of the Witch, right?
That has actually become very popular in recent
years. I know, which is crazy because
I have to watch it again and like see why people are flocking to it all of a sudden. But it's what Halloween did was set up these tropes that allowed these movies afterwards to become hits. It's really interesting because in a sense, like, Laurie Strode is a final girl while not actually a final girl. Because, like, for the final girl trope, in the way it was first coined by someone whose name I totally forgot in the 90s, the final girl has, like, two different levels to it. Where it's, like, it's the final girl is, like, that virtuous girl who survives at the end because she's not having promiscuous sex, mm-hmm. and she's not doing a bunch of drugs and stuff. But in Psycho, in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, in this movie, they aren't quite that highest elevated level of final girl because they're still saved by a man in the end. Mm-hmm. Right? Where, in fact, two of those movies, they're both saved by a man with the same name?
Really?
Yeah. What's the name of the doctor in this?
I always forget what his name is.
It's Sam Loomis.
Oh, yeah, Sam Loomis. Well, because Loomis was a producer on these movies, not Sam Loomis, but something.
Yeah, Loomis. But Carpenter definitely named the doctor Sam Loomis in this as a callback to Psycho, which is another reason why like this movie has to come in for Psycho. And whereas, like, the true final girl saves herself. Someone like Sidney Prescott, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He's a true final girl where they're overcoming the villain themselves. But even in that instance, a lot of those times, like, the trope of the final girl is a little undermined by them taking on a very, like, specific masculine role with a very phallic-shaped weapon. Mm. And like
you've done way more research into this than I have. That's for sure.
I have. It was interesting. We're talking about a movie not on our list, so it's good to talk about the history of the movie.
I hear you. I did not do this research, but I appreciate it.
So when you consider that aspect of it, you just have to look at it and think of like what this movie set up. Like I'm looking at like something like Scream, which is one of my favorite movies. Like, that movie can't exist without Halloween. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis has gone on to be considered one of the greatest Scream Queens of all time. Literally being in a show called Scream Queens because of what she made of herself in Halloween.
And it's so funny because Jamie Lee Curtis, I was looking her up, has almost done nothing else.
Yeah. Like,
she has been in barely anything.
If you think about movies Jamie Lee Curtis has been in, a lot of them are Halloweens.
Yeah, and then Freaky Friday.
Yeah.
And A Fish Called Wanda, True Lies. Think of something, like, you can't think of a movie beyond those.
Yeah, there's not a lot. But it's still great. Like, she made this career out of it. And she's this horror icon because of it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that her character in this movie kind of sucks.
Yeah.
Like, she's a stick in the mud for most of it. Like, we get the one scene where she's toking on the joint as they're, like, driving past the hardware store. Other than that, she's pretty boring. She's a stickler. She wants to go back for her, like, chemistry book.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, not a fun person. But no. Because of that, it's because of that virtuosity that she's able to survive in the end. So it's just this building of tropes that are so cemented into what horror is now that if this movie never happened, we wouldn't have any of these, even these elevated horror movies that you mentioned, Phil, like It Follows or The Babadook or Hereditary. Like, those type of movies don't exist if Halloween never happened.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I mean, I think too, like, you have to think in the 70s was when, you know, you started to get, you know, obviously the next year you get Alien, which is definitely more of a sci-fi horror, but then, you know, Aliens is a pure sci-fi action. So, you know, you're getting that type of horror. You had The Exorcist, which was more of that supernatural horror. You had gone through those black and whites, like The Innocence, The Uninvited, movies like that, yeah. Where, you know, The Haunted House, this was moving away from The Haunted House. I think that was the biggest thing. Like, the 70s was definitely the era, because Psycho was a standalone in 1960.
Yeah.
Psycho was not, that was uncommon. If you haven't seen Diabolique, that's a very good movie. It's a French movie. I probably butchered the way it's pronounced, but it's diabolical. If you haven't seen that, check that movie out, because that is very, I forget which one came first, that or Psycho, but either way, they inspired each other. But Psycho stood alone. So now the 70s is starting to get away from black and white haunted house. The Exorcist is a girl who's possessed. Halloween is a slasher film. Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that cabin in the woods type thing. Alien is now you're in space and whatever. Like, you're starting to move in that direction. The inspiration for a lot of, like, It Follows, definitely inspired by Halloween. Something like Hereditary, that feels like it's pulling to me more from like an Exorcist type thing, where it's like, there's nothing we can do. So my biggest problem with this, and next week we're going to talk about the movie that possibly launched the worst genre of film in the history of film. Like, and it's a great movie, but it launched the worst genre, which is the found footage genre in the Blair Witch Project. For me, Halloween just created so many immediately bad movies.
Sure.
There are so many bad, like the 90s. What are your classic 90s horror movies? And I mean horror where it's not Scream. Like, Scream isn't a horror movie. Like, that is a deconstruction of a genre. What's your classic horror 90s movies? The Silence of the Lambs? Sure. Like I said, I think that's more of a thriller. But once you get beyond that, what are you going to in the 90s as your, whoa, that's it? Because the 80s just burned horror out because of the success of Halloween. And so that's where I think, like, for Halloween, it doesn't stand up for me, because I didn't get into the whole, like, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, Halloween 4, Halloween 5. And Halloween never scared me the way Jaws scared me from going in the ocean, or the way Psycho scared me from taking a shower in a hotel. Like, that just wasn't what happened with this movie for me. Maybe it's because it's, like, an all-female cast. Who knows? But it just didn't hit me in that way. And I also think it's dumb. If Michael Myers is torturing you, get in a car, just drive as far away as you can as soon as you see something weird, and whatever. I mean, and It Follows, they make fun of that trope by being like, well, it'll just walk in a straight line until it gets to you. Like,
yeah,
that's essentially what's happening in these movies. And it's like, man, Jamie Lee Curtis, all you got to do is just get in the car and just keep driving. So yeah, I get why people really like Halloween. And like I said, I don't dislike this movie. It's just like, I look at 4 years later, and obviously he was so inspired to make that movie, but with The Thing,
yeah,
like The Thing is such a masterpiece. And that's the type of movie that I'm like, okay, now I can get behind this low budget. Like, that's the kind of fear. That's the kind of fun. Like, Halloween, I will say this, I just don't think it's that much fun. I don't, yeah, like, for this type of genre, it doesn't bring that, like, fun element that a lot of these like high school slasher flicks were bringing with it. Even The Exorcist, as messed up as that movie is, there's kind of like there's a mystery element to it. Psycho has a mystery element to it. Halloween doesn't really have a mystery element to it. You know, Michael Myers murdered, you know, Michael Myers come back to town, and you know, Donald Pleasance is behind him. That's it.
My big question when it comes to Halloween is, how impactful is this movie by itself at the time? Like, if we're not looking, like, yes, we're looking at it from a historical standpoint of like what it did for horror, but what if like we didn't have all those slasher movies in the 80s? Like, this movie is better because of that. I mean, LFG or METS just said, I think the other adaptations of Halloween makes the original look bad. And That's a good point, because a lot of them do. Like, with the
exception, that's the same thing that was happening with Scream for a while there.
Yeah.
The Scream sequels were so bad that it made Scream seem like a joke.
I mean, there's one bad Scream sequel, and that's it.
Okay. Okay. There's one bad Scream sequel. Mm-hmm. But either way, once you start making sequels, it's the same thing. The Exorcist 2 is one of the worst movies ever made. Jaws 2, Jaws 3, they're terrible. Like, once you start making sequels to these movies, it always cheapens the original, because also what they do, and it's the biggest mistake in horror, is they start to give you too much information about your bad guy.
Yes.
And once you know, like Psycho 2, disaster. I don't need to know more about Norman Bates. Norman Bates already did what he needed to do. Like, once you start to know about them, they become less scary because now you know everything about them. So, that's the same thing Metz here said with Rob Zombie giving Michael Myers a backstory that makes no sense. You don't need a backstory for Michael Myers. He murdered his sister. That's all I need to know.
Yeah, and it, like, when we look at that opening sequence of this film, it's all shot in first person. I don't know if you noticed this, but it's actually a woman's hand, not a child's hand, that's holding the knife in this scene. Mm-hmm. It's actually one of the female producers who are doing it. But like that reveal of Michael Myers being like this kid, it's to send dread. Like, that's the whole point of the character of Michael Myers, is that he's supposed to be this embodiment of evil, right? And that's what Loomis tells us the entire film. Like, there is fear in Loomis this entire film, and it helps build Michael Myers into what he is. What we see Michael Myers do, I mean, it's kind of the same as any other real, like, serial killer. Yes, it's extensive in a single night, right? And obviously there's the whole, like, not dying when shot thing.
Yeah.
But in the end, like, there's so much buildup in this movie, not just because of, like, what the kids are saying about the boogeyman stuff, but because of Loomis just explaining over and over again how horrifying Michael Myers is, that he becomes this like specter of death. He becomes this looming, terrifying image when he's just standing there. The way Michael Myers is presented in this movie is as a predator, right? He stalks his prey. Is there any reason he's going after Laurie Strode at all, were it not for the fact that she happened to go up onto the porch of the Myers house that morning?
Yeah.
We don't know. And that's where kind of like the horror of this comes from. Yeah, I get this not being as scary as some other movies, right? I personally don't prefer the slasher genre. I prefer supernatural horror and like slow burn psychological horror. Those are my preferred genres. We're going to see that over the next 33 weeks. Mm-hmm. But I still feel like it just has this place, and it's like, no, I'm not good. I don't go back to Halloween all the time because it's fine. I went through that huge slasher binge back in October, November of this past year. I watched some truly dreadful movies during that time because of Halloween. But when you consider the fact that it gives us this faceless villain in Michael Myers, it gives us this presence of the slasher, where the slasher, like you said, slashers got worse the more we saw the slasher. Mm-hmm. You don't see Michael Myers a lot in this movie.
No, he's really more of a idea a lot of the time.
Yeah, which is exactly what I love about how Carpenter approaches. And you combine that with Carpenter's phenomenal score that he did himself. That's so simplistic, but so recognizable. Everyone knows the score to Halloween as soon as they hear it. You combine it with a equally incredible performance from Donald Pleasance in this film. Like you said, it's a good movie. I don't blame anyone for not having this movie as like their favorite horror movie, because it's not my favorite horror movie. Mm-hmm. But it's a good one that if you are a fan of horror and you really want that to understand the history of horror, you have to watch this movie.
No, for sure. And it's definitely worth the watch. Like, I would say Friday the 13th is not worth the watch. Like, I don't believe Nightmare on Elm Street, I'd probably say go ahead and watch it. You're going to enjoy it. Friday the 13th is not. Jeepers Creepers, which came out about 23 years after this one, I think is a good watch. Like, I think it is fun. And that's where what Raptor here says, slashers typically aren't good, but they're preferably fun. I don't find Halloween to be all that fun. Donald Pleasance, though, is very good in this. And I like what they did with this, where Michael Myers isn't scary because of anything else. Michael Myers is scary because we watch him murder his sister. And then he's scary because now we see a grown man 30 years later, or whatever it is, still terrified of Michael Myers. So we know that even though he's been locked up, you can't trust this guy. I just really appreciate it. If you haven't, and I just got to throw this one out for anybody who likes horror. It's not necessarily a horror, but it's definitely a creepy ass movie. If you want to watch another good, great, it's a great movie. Donald Pleasance, watch Wake and Fright. Wake and Fright is an Australian movie. It's so freaking good and so freaking disturbing. Worth watching. That's all. It's worth it. And every time I watch this, I'm like, Donald Pleasance was so underused because of the time. Like, he's great in You Only Live Twice. He's great in Halloween. He's great in Wake and Fright. He just wasn't very good looking. And that hurt him from getting a lot more roles than what he ended up getting. And Donald Pleasance is good in this. Honestly, like, Jamie Lee Curtis doesn't really do much the entire movie. I mean, she doesn't have to, but I do think that's why, like, Sidney Prescott and Scream is I'm always going to prefer Scream to Halloween, because Scream is just more fun. This just isn't that fun.
Exactly.
But it depends what you're looking for. I mean, if you've ever had somebody break into your house before, then maybe this is the most terrifying movie of all time. But I'm much more scared of driving across the country and being in the middle of nowhere and somebody abducts you or somebody does something like that, or the supernatural that you have no control over.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the big thing, right? Like, you have to look at the time this movie was made and when slasher started taking over. And a lot of it had to do with, like, there were a lot of serial killers in America at this time.
That's true. We all, it's also hard. And I think that's a very good point, John. It's very hard to imagine just how terrifying it was back in the late 70s when there was barely any communication between people. People would go missing for 3 days and then show back up and they weren't actually like abducted or anything. That can't happen now because you know where everybody is at all times. And I do think that's a great point, because it's not like they could just be texting each other. Oh, what are you doing? Where are you? What's going on?
Blah, blah, blah. Exactly, like, right? They're phoning each other. It's creepy. Across the street from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very different. And I do think that's a good point. I mean, this was not what all this stuff wasn't far on the heels of Ted Bundy and all the other serial killers. Zodiac killer. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Doesn't make me like the movie anymore, but it's a very good point.
No, but I mean, that historical context is so important when it comes to horror movies, because even if we look at, we were talking about horror in the 90s and how a lot of it sucks, because a lot of it does, unless you go to other countries. Mm-hmm. It's like there are lot of good foreign horror movies from the 90s, things like Funny Games or Audition, but like there is a different type of horror than what was than what we're used to in North America. Like, it's like how a lot of North American horror is about, like I said earlier, it takes place on the edges of society, right? On the in the woods and stuff. I lived in the middle of nowhere Canada. Mm-hmm. Where I was, like, it took 45 minutes for an ambulance to get to you. Mm-hmm. Like, the edges of society don't scare me. Mm-hmm. And like, that's the interesting thing when it comes to slasher movies, is because they take place in our backyard. They make you question. It's also when, like, you know, North America also has this fascination with, like, stranger danger, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a thing in the rest of the world.
No.
Right? And that, I think, stems from, like, these slasher movies where, like, they kind of perpetuate each other. And it gives you that thought process that, like, something bad can happen in your backyard. Mm-hmm. And you should be scared of everything. It kind of leads to that American isolationism.
Yeah.
That we're just so used to.
Yeah. No, I agree. I wonder, you know, because they've tried to reboot this a million times. I wonder if they'll be able to get the slasher genre to ever come back to like anything remotely close to what it was, or if it's just like the other night I watched a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie. Those movies are long gone. They were so popular at the time and now they're long gone. Is that what the slasher genre is at this point for horror? Like, you can't make just a slasher movie anymore.
A24 released one earlier this year called X. I think it was a Ty West film, actually.
Okay.
I haven't watched it yet. I've been meaning to for quite some time. But I, from what I under, it was well received, but it's still not a typical slasher movie.
Yeah. Ty West doesn't make typical slasher movies. Yeah. He does his own thing.
So I don't think, I think we're at a point where horror movies are, we're asking horror movies to be more elevated. The fact that studios give horror movies a lot more leeway than they do other movies. We expect horror movies to reflect society and to be commentary on society. And a lot of slasher movies that we got in the 80s just don't do that.
Yeah, I agree. All right, John, well, let's move on. Let's move on to the best thing we watched this week. And for anybody who's discussing, we have a pretty active chat here. Maybe it's because we're doing it in the afternoon. We did start up a Discord for patrons for Survivor and for the movies. And that's going to be going through forever now. All you got to do is it's $1 a month if you want to join the Discord and you can have a discussion about any movie you ever wanted in Movie Buff Specialist one. We have different things for the higher tier patrons, but that's mostly Survivor related stuff. So if you're not a Survivor fan, there's really no reason to do that. But if you just want to come in, talk movies, John and I are both in there. You know, if you questions, you know, you watch something, you just want to post it in there. We have a Discord. It's just starting to build up because we just started it mid this week, but we're hoping that this is really going to become a conversation spot. So it's patreon.com/survivor specialist. John, what was the best thing you watched this week?
I was really concerned because until this morning, I had only watched two movies outside of the two for this week's podcast, and they were Thor, Love and Thunder and the Bob's Burgers movie. And let me just tell you, the latter, much better than the first one. But luckily I did watch two very good movies today. I watched Videodrome, David Cronenberg's movie today. That's a weird one.
I haven't seen that.
It's a weird one. It's worth a watch. I did enjoy it quite a lot. It's very early Cronenberg, and it's great because of it. But I think I have to give the best one this week to Dazed and Confused.
Go ahead.
Let me tell you, way different than what I expected that movie to be.
Oh, so that was your first time watching it?
It was.
See, it's funny because Everybody Wants Some, which is in my top 20,
yeah,
is like the spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused. And I really heavily prefer Everybody Wants Some. Most people don't, but I heavily prefer Everybody Wants Some. I like Dazed and Confused, but Everybody Wants Some to me is more the college experience, whereas my high school experience wasn't really anything like what I was seeing in Dazed and Confused. But Linklater, man, he just captures an era, huh?
He does. And what was really interesting, I kind of went into this movie thinking it was closer to like Fast Times. But let's be real, this is just American Graffiti.
Yeah, it is. It's American Graffiti with more drugs.
Yeah, it's just a different time period, right?
Yeah.
And it was great. If it's not for that like really mediocre first half hour of the film where they're doing all the hazing and stuff, this movie would be a masterpiece, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that's why I like Everybody Wants Them, because they just get right into, this is the story.
Yeah, but it has all of those elements of a great hangout movie. And I've always kind of thought about to myself, like, do I enjoy hangout movies? And I was going through it today and, like, thinking about hangout movies that I watch. And it's like, yeah, I really do enjoy hangout movies. I enjoy the fact that, like, they're so slice of life. You get a feel. You get more real characters in hangout movies. But you still get these, like, deep philosophical questions throughout the movies. And when you take that aspect of just the hangout movie and add in some of this like Linklater cinematography and direction, it's a great combination.
Yeah.
Movie far surpassed my expectations, especially when you consider like the Amazon description for this movie does not do this movie justice.
Yeah, no, they never do. Yeah, Dazed and Confused is like a classic at this point. I mean, it's 30 years old, which is crazy, but it's a classic. Everybody wants them is just what I prefer, but we'll talk about that when we actually get there. I watched a couple good ones this week. I watched a lot of movies this week. I finally got around. I've been trying to go through now and like I have five Best Picture winners left, but then I added all of the Best Picture nominees that I have not seen to my watch list just so that like I can kind of go through those. I already had enough other movies on my watch list. And like now I have like a complete watch list that I can work my way through and then just start watching other stuff after that. And, you know, obviously new stuff comes out, I'll watch that. But just, you know, for older stuff, what am I looking for? Now I don't have to really do too much thought. What's a little bit shorter? What's a little bit longer, depending on time? So I watched a couple this week that were 3.5 stars. One of those was 1-2-3, which is a James Cagney, Billy Wilder movie. That was a good one. It's about communist versus capitalist type stuff. It's very fun. I watched Awakenings, which was much better than I thought it was going to be with Robert De Niro and Robert Williams. I thought it was good. I thought that movie was going to be much more like melodramatic than it was. And it's melodramatic, but the acting is great. It's a fun story. Finally got around to watching All That Jazz, which is the Bob Fosse kind of autobiography. That is something. That was not as good as I thought it was going to be, but the ending, the last 30 minutes is some of the best I've ever seen. It's just the rest of the movie I didn't think was that good. I gave it 3.5 stars. It was on its way to being like a 2.5, 3 for me until the last half hour. And then I was like, holy shit, this movie's crazy. Just some balls on that guy to make that movie. But the best one I watched this week was a spaghetti Western called Bandidos, which is from 1967. I only have it because my friend accidentally ordered a double of Revenge Tales, which was like these 4 spaghetti Westerns that came, and he just sent me one because he had ordered 2 of them. It's friggin' awesome. Like, it is a great spaghetti Western, a great revenge movie, and it's actually incredibly well directed. The cinematographer or the director had worked a lot with Sergio Leone as a cinematographer. And so like there's a train robbery scene at the beginning, which is just freaking beautiful. The ending is great, but it just ticks off. It's fun. The characters are enjoyable. Spaghetti Westerns are kind of like slasher movies. Fun is better than serious. This movie's very fun, but then it has its serious moments. I thought it was awesome and definitely worth checking out if you can get your hands on it. It's called Bandidos, Bandidos. All right. On to my number 34, we're talking The Royal Tenenbaums. So actually, John, a movie that was not on your list, which I was kind of surprised at when I think the list first came out, because I knew you liked Wes Anderson. But this is not my favorite Wes Anderson movie. Moonrise Kingdom is my favorite one. But to me, this was when Wes Anderson figured out who the hell he was. And this is just the quintessential Wes Anderson. If you were to say, what is a Wes Anderson movie? Slow motion walking, family drama, a great soundtrack, characters who are weirdly suicidal, but in like the most unique way. Characters who are in love with each other in ways that they shouldn't be, maybe, like who the hell knows. And just like alienation, like just feeling alone, even though you're in like a group. This was that. Like, this was the defining Wes Anderson movie. And it's 21 years old now. And it just, I mean, to me, it holds up better than a lot of movies of the era. Like, it was so distinctly Wes's style. The opening monologue with Alec Baldwin probably goes on a little too long at this point, just because like now you know the character so well because you've seen the movie so many times. But when this movie starts clicking, when Gene Hackman starts clicking, when you start getting into the Richie Tenenbaum, Margot Tenenbaum stuff, it's just second to none. I mean, it just keeps going. The soundtrack is phenomenal. I've always been disappointed with Wes Anderson movies since, because the soundtracks never come close to The Royal Tenenbaums. Darjeeling is close. Maybe a little bit of Life Aquatic, but I hated that movie so much, it doesn't matter. But this movie just has such a great soundtrack with the Velvet Underground and the Rolling Stones and Nico and just everything. It's just perfectly made. It was his style, and Gene Hackman's performance is fantastic. Believe it or not, I think Gene Hackman won 2 Golden Globes for The French Connection and for this. This was the other movie that he won the Golden Globe for, if I'm not mistaken. But I know he did win the Golden Globe for this movie. He's fantastic in this movie. And the character of Royal is just so great to watch. And let me see, Golden Globe. Now I need to find it so I can actually say, I guess he won three because he won for Unforgiven. I always forget about that movie. Unforgiven, The Royal Tenenbaums, and he did win for The French Connection. So he won three times. But it's so unlike what you were used to seeing Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman was very much like one of those like tough guy, cool guys in movies in the 70s and 80s. And to have him come out and just be a pure prick. What is it? You're not an asshole. You're just kind of a son of a bitch. I appreciate that. Like, the dialogue is second to none. His performance is great. The characters are great. I could just praise this movie. Like, I love it. I really do. I love all of it.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal film. And there's no, like, questions about it. Like you said, this is the point where Wes Anderson really becomes Wes Anderson. I think it sits in, like, the 3 to 4 range for Wes Anderson films for me. Maybe like 3 to 5, probably 4, like 3 or 4 though. Obviously with me having 2 other Wes Anderson films in my top 100. But when you watch Rushmore, which he made right before this, and then you go to this, they're drastically different. Both good films. Like, Rushmore is still a great film. But The Royal Tenenbaums, like you said, captures everything of what you think Wes Anderson is supposed to be, right? Like, Wes Anderson makes these family dramas into these quirky comedies, and you don't have to be, like, family, per se. Like, it could be the crew of a marine vessel or, like, the staff of a hotel. He makes everything into a family when he creates these movies. And Royal Tenenbaums just completely does that. We see, like, Gene Hackman, absolutely incredible in this film. And this is one of his last films, too, because Welcome to Mooseport happened shortly afterwards, and he decided to never act again because of that movie. And I don't blame him. That is the only movie I've never finished.
It was terrible.
Yeah. But at the heart of this movie, it's just about a man trying to atone for the neglect he gave his family and just, like, be happy for once. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a beautiful, small story filled with all these absurdities.
Yeah. And I think, okay, so I gotta pull this up because I always forget exactly what it says, but I always love the ending. I tragically rescuing his family from the wreckage of a destroyed sinking battleship. And obviously it's outlandish and it's funny and it's like, ah, what a headstone. And, you know, you hear him saying earlier, but in reality, he saved his family from falling apart. Margo's sitting in a bathtub for hours on end. Chaz is not able to get over his wife's death. Richie is traveling around the world on a boat, completely miserable. Etheline doesn't know how to take these next steps with, Danny Glover's character. Was it Harry, Henry, Hank? Yeah, because he keeps calling him Hank. And Eli Cash is a drug addict. And it takes Royal coming back into all of their lives for everything to start to move and for the conversations to start to happen and for everybody to start to find out, like, how to start living again. I always love the part where Royal Tenenbaum is talking about, you know, I'm dying. And she's like, what is it? Blah, blah, blah. And she starts breathing. He's like, well, I'm not really dying. And she loses it. You son of a bitch, blah, blah. I am dying, though. And, like, the truth of that is he is dying. Like, he is, you know, he does have a health problem. He is getting closer to death. He's not technically lying, but it's not this stomach cancer that he's pretending it to be. And I love when Henry finds out that it's Tic Tacs. I mean, I just think that part's so funny.
Yeah.
But to see everything they went through as children in that opening, and then to get into the actual story and see where they're all at and see now that they're back under one roof. As soon as Chaz gets under that one roof, his whole personality changes. He's no longer the really fearful guy. Now he's pissed off at his father and he's got to put on that shell again, that mask. And Margo is trying to be secretive. And Richie just was always the dad's favorite. So now what, like, I love how that all starts to take place and how Royal really does bring out the best in all of them, despite being a son of a bitch. And that is such a hard thing to pull off. How many movies in the last 20 years have tried and failed to do what the Royal Tenenbaums did? It's countless. It's the same thing as Halloween, right? Like, it's the same thing as Halloween. It invented sort of a genre. We had never seen this level of quirky family. We'd seen quirky families, whatever, like funny, but we had never seen this level. And so many people wanted to follow that afterwards. And nobody, in my opinion, has been able to hit this level with a family drama comedy. The one that was the most blatant ripoff of it was Running with Scissors. And Running with Scissors was essentially this movie. And it doesn't even come close. Like, it doesn't even come close. Yeah. And it's just hard, because how do you do this? This is anything that you make that's like this now is going to be like, wow, that's like the Royal Tenenbaums. Like, wow, that's like that. And what's craziest is the Royal Tenenbaums wasn't a massive, massive, massive box office and critical success. It was nominated for one Oscar for screenplay. That was it. Gene Hackman won at the Golden Globes. That was it. And what this made Wes Anderson, but if this movie had come out in 2014 and Grand Budapest Hotel had come out in 2001, Royal Tenenbaums would be the one that's winning all the awards, and Grand Budapest Hotel would be the one that's more of the like cult classic. Because at the end of the day, this really is like a cult classic at this point. It's just that now those who really love Wes Anderson are no longer part of a cult because he's just hit the mainstream so hard.
Well, and that's the big thing is like you look at this film and it's like, the Royal Tenenbaums didn't even catapult Wes Anderson to this mainstream director at all. Like, he didn't get that until Moonrise Kingdom came out in 2012.
Yeah. Like, after this was Life Aquatic, which, you know, then Darjeeling.
Phil doesn't like, but it's good. The Life Aquatic is great. Anyone on this podcast tells you.
Yeah, well, that's fine. But then it goes to Darjeeling. But these movies were not the box office successes they need to be.
No.
Fantastic Mr. Fox was a different one. And then Moonrise Kingdom, when it was like, okay, let's pay a little bit closer attention. And then Grand Budapest Hotel just launched him into stardom.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, since then, I don't think he's really made very good movies. But, you know, that's to each their own. I know you like the French Dispatch. I didn't really like the French Dispatch that much. I thought it was uneven. I liked it. I just thought it was uneven. It didn't live up to the hype in my brain.
So Isle of Dogs.
You like Isle of Dogs?
No, that's what I'm saying. It's no Isle of Dogs.
No, Isle of Dogs is garbage. Like, Isle of Dogs is the worst Wes Anderson movie, and it's really not even close. But it cracks me up because after the Grand Budapest Hotel came out, Isle of Dogs got great reviews because it was the movie that followed that up, and critics were now all over Wes Anderson. People weren't all over him in that same way when the Darjeeling Limited came out, which I think the Darjeeling Limited is a great movie. And I think Darjeeling Limited is probably my fourth favorite of the Wes Anderson movies. Fifth, I guess. But the ones that are ahead of it are Royal Tenenbaums, Moonrise Kingdom, Grand Budapest Hotel, and Fantastic Mr. Fox. Sorry, you're fifth to that, but there's not a bad – there's a four-star movie in front of you.
Yeah.
So that's what makes it tough. But it's just – it's interesting that it kind of defined the 2000s. Like, if you really think about it, this movie defines what is to follow – and yet it didn't really gain the notoriety of being like one of the definitive films of the 2000s until the 2010s. Like, it didn't have that initial, like Gladiator. As soon as that came out, everybody's like, that's a definitive movie. You know what I mean? Like, No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood. Like, those are movies people would not stop talking about. This movie is kind of like Mulholland Drive, where they didn't really start to gain that, like, this is a definitive movie of this decade until the decade was over. Which they both came out so early in the decade that that's just unusual. Had he made this 5 years ago, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that it would have been a Best Picture nominee and arguably won, potentially.
It helps that they had more than five Best Picture nominees at that time, too.
2001 was also one of the greatest years for film of all time. And
yeah, there's that problem, too.
Brave saying that.
But, yeah, I mean... it's just the way Wes Anderson creates this family and the tensions between this family. It just builds up how dysfunctional the family is. Like, yeah, we get the opening sequence with the Alec Baldwin narration where he's like explaining how awful Royal is to his entire family. But it's not until like you slowly build up each of these characters after they're reintroduced that you truly understand how dysfunctional this family is. But that's what makes it so much more heartwarming when they do start connecting. And it's not like they're connecting over some like terrible thing that's happening. Yes, I mean, obviously Royal's lying about dying and everything.
Yeah.
But like, even after that fact, we see them healing even more when it becomes clear that Royal's just, what's the line that he says? Where was it? I wrote it down. I know I did.
Better find it.
I had to. Oh, it's the conversation he has where it's like you were never really dying. But I'm going to live. Like, that is such a phenomenal exchange.
Yeah.
Such a phenomenal line, and like the delivery that Gene Hackman gives it. It's just like you can see in this character that he's just come to this realization that everything he's done up to this point doesn't matter because he didn't have his family to celebrate it with.
And to me, that is one of the best lines Wes Anderson ever wrote. You were never really dying, but now I'm going to live. Like, that is so much deeper. Like, it's a joke, first of all. It's a comedic line.
Yeah.
But it's so much deeper than it has any right to be. Mm-hmm. And it just hits you, and you're like, he is going to live. Like, because now he is. He's going to enjoy it, and now all of them are going to live. I don't really like Rushmore. I think Jason Schwartzman's a whiny little baby in it. It drives me crazy. And I'm a huge Jason Schwartzman fan. I mean, so that's
he is. Wild. That's the character. Yeah.
I can't stand it, though. Like, it's too much for me. It just goes too far. But, like, you think about, like, in the hospital, why'd you try to kill yourself? Well, I wrote a suicide note. Can I read it? No. Or, like, whatever it was. Yeah, you did? Yeah, right after I regained consciousness. That's what he says.
Yeah.
Like, so he wrote the suicide note after he woke up from almost dying. Can we read it? No. Is it dark? Of course it's dark. It's a suicide note. Like, those are those lines that Wes Anderson became known for, and that like wit that even in the movies that people didn't necessarily love, that's the kind of stuff that was like, it just felt like he was talking on like a higher level because he's almost doing, like there's the comedian Stephen Wright who would just have one-liners the whole time, you know, like everything was just like the punchline was in the sentence he was saying. That's what Wes Anderson is doing, and that's what he's able to do so well in this movie. I don't know, like the whole thing with Margot Tenenbaum, and then it's so she smokes. Like, nobody's surprised that she's cheating on everybody. They just can't believe she smokes, which not for nothing. Like, and even before he says, "But I'm going to live, Richie. This illness is close to death. It's had a profound effect on me." Like, sometimes it just takes realizing what you're losing to realize what you need to keep going. And that's what this movie does so well. The same thing when Richie tries to kill himself and then he comes out and him and Margot have their moment. And it's, you know, just such a fantastic moment with, I guess we'll just have to be secretly in love, cut to the chorus of Ruby Tuesday. And then him hanging the javelina. I mean, that's just like, that's just next level stuff, but it's all those near losses that lead to this gaining something. And yeah, I mean, the other thing with this, there's what, 8 main characters in this movie, and every one of them gets their moment.
Yep.
Nobody's been able to pull that off in an hour and 15 minute movie like this either. And they always try. How can we get the quirk in? How can we get the quirk in? How can we get the quirk in? Eli Cash doesn't need more than 5 minutes in this movie.
Yep.
You know, Pagoda is a great character, and Pagoda's barely in the movie, but he's a great character. There, Henry Sherman is barely in the movie. But we get what he is like, and you have Royal to hold it all together. It's incredibly well structured, and it's just incredibly well made.
Yeah, and I think it's one of the, because this is the time where Wes Anderson, Rushmore's not an ensemble film, right? Like Rushmore and Bottle Rocket are not the ensemble films that Wes Anderson's known for. This is kind of where Wes Anderson just creates his like. His theater troupe, right? Like, you look at these people, and most of them have been in a lot of Wes Anderson movies. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, this movie's perfectly cast. Wes Anderson was just able to perfectly find the people who could embody these characters so well.
Like, because really, other than what, Gene Hackman and Danny Glover, they've all been back.
Yes.
Angelica Houston has been back, right?
Yeah, she was in Darjeeling for sure.
And maybe she was Gwyneth in Life of Paltrow.
Aquatic. Gwyneth was Paltrow, I think, is the one. I don't know about Gwyneth Paltrow. I can't think off the top of my head.
That's right. She didn't need to do another Wes Anderson movie because Margot Tenenbaum's like iconic at this point. So,
well, and you were talking about like the influence of this movie on on comedy for the 2000s. Margot Tenenbaum has to be one of the prototypical manic pixie dream girls, right?
She's the original. In my opinion, and I know that this was a trope that was going on before. Like, there were always manic pixie dream girls. They just didn't know what to call it. She was the first of this kind, though. Think about the movies that came after Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind came out 3 years later.
Yep.
Clementine Krasinski is probably the most iconic Manic Pixie Dream Girl, but Margot Tenenbaum began this. And that's where I say, like, when I say that this is, to me, like, I have movies from the 2000s ranked higher than this that I think are better movies. But if you were to ask me what are the two defining movies of the 2000s, one of them would be in my top 100 and one of them wouldn't be. One is this and one is There Will Be Blood. Because There Will Be Blood got into the negativity of the late 2000s during the end of the Bush era in America when people felt hopeless. There was the housing market collapse. We were coming into the Obama years where we thought everything was going to get better. Didn't really start off getting all that much better all that quickly because things just weren't moving. Because how can you come back from that? And so that is getting into the negativity of everything that people were feeling. Because remember, in 2001, George W. Bush had the highest rating of any president in American history, approval rating. People loved him after 9/11. So to me, this is just the defining movie because There Will Be Blood takes the negative. This takes what tropes started to ruin movies. Like the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, the super depressed guy, which is Richie Tenenbaum. That is such an overused trope, that numb, like, I'm not going to say anything. That was a character we really hadn't seen before. And there it was. And this is what people wanted family comedies to be after this. They just didn't know how to make it in this way. And they were never able to get back to that originality. This movie has so much originality to it. But it was, there was just something about this time period. Divorces were becoming more popular. Things like that were happening a lot more in the country than they had previously. Like, and Wes Anderson was able to take all of that and show the value of everybody, even when you don't necessarily, you're not necessarily still connected. And that's why I think it's just definitive. It changed the way that women were written in movies for the better and for the worse. But I think a character like Clementine Krasinski, like, is absolutely for the better. I mean, that she's not even a Manic Pixie Dream Girl. She's just a human being. It's unbelievable what Charlie Kaufman was able to do with that character. But it just changed what our protagonist looked like.
Yeah.
In the 90s, it was the macho man stuff. You know, is the Jean-Claude Van Damme, Sylvester Stallone carryover, all that nonsense. Yeah. In the 80s, it was the Arnold Schwarzenegger era. Like, it was things like that that we were seeing. Like, it was always big and buff. In the 70s, it was more of the war hero or the people coming back from the war not knowing what to do, but it was like your everyday man. This was taking it to such an extreme in another way, coming a year after Gladiator, where Maximus is, you know, iconic and such a larger-than-life hero. There's no hero's journey for anybody in this. But they're all overcoming things, and I think that's everybody could see themselves in someone in this movie. And I think that's why it influenced so much of the writing that came after it. I mean, and think about the ensemble movies that came out later during that decade that probably never Crash, Babel, Bobby, which was the movie about Bobby Kennedy being assassinated, which was like a massive ensemble. You don't have to like these movies, but think about how many of them were coming out after this, where they were trying to get into the minds of all these different characters. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But this is what probably led them to that. It wasn't Magnolia, you know, which is miserable. It was this.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. I mean, it is a really iconic movie, and it is surprising this movie doesn't get talked about more in the long run of things, where Wes Anderson's name gets out there a lot, but like the Royal Tenenbaum still just doesn't seem to be talked about as much as it should be.
I do think that changed as well, though, in 2012 when Moonrise Kingdom came out. I think prior to Moonrise Kingdom, he really was the Royal Tenenbaum's guy. Fantastic Mr. Fox is a phenomenal movie and one that got critical acclaim at the time, was nominated for Oscars, everything like that. But it also came out the same year as Up, so it was overshadowed quite significantly. However, Moonrise Kingdom was like, ooh, indie sensation that comes out in May. That's different. Like, what are we looking at here? This is different. And people started to latch on to that. And that was the same year as like, or maybe it was the year after, whatever, but like with Shame was coming out around that time. Shame might've been the year before, but either way, like it's starting to get into these like more indie, whatever. And now Wes Anderson had another movie that was live action to hang his hat on. Darjeeling, Life Aquatic, those didn't do it for a lot of people. Whether you love them or hate them, they didn't do it for enough audiences to really build him up. And it started to feel like, is Wes Anderson just a one-trick pony? He had his one really big hit and everything else, he's just going to be a kind of a cult hero. And then Moonrise came out. And I think when Moonrise came out, that shifted the focus from, oh, let's talk about the Royal Tenenbaums all the time. You should go see this movie, Moonrise Kingdom. And then when the Grand Budapest Hotel came out, now you had two movies that were more modern that people were more infatuated with, and they didn't need to go back and talk about the Royal Tenenbaums anymore. Between 2001 and 2011, if you liked Wes Anderson, you talked about the Royal Tenenbaums to as many people as you could because you knew that would be the one that would get them to actually watch a Wes Anderson movie. You knew that Life Aquatic wasn't going to be that movie. You would ease them in with Royal Tenenbaums and then try to work to Rushmore and to Bottle Rocket and to Darjeeling and Life Aquatic. Moonrise and Grand Budapest changed that. And now in the 10 years since Moonrise Kingdom came out, which makes me super depressed.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. The 10 years since that came out, Royal Tenenbaums has become older and people just aren't talking about it nearly as much.
Yeah. I didn't think about the fact that, like, I remember as a kid seeing like promotional material for Life Aquatic and for Darjeeling Unlimited and thinking these are movies I want to see, but I never got into Wes Anderson until after Moonrise Kingdom. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those things where it's like, I was kind of young still when those movies came out. Cause what, it was like 2003 was the Life Aquatic?
2004.
So like, you know, I'm 12 years old, 13 years old at that point. I was still a little young to be watching Wes Anderson movies, but I knew at that age that those were the type of movies that would appeal to me. And then here we are.
I'm talking about them now.
2022, talking about them.
Yeah, Royal Tenenbaums came on my radar because one of my best friends, it was his favorite movie when we were in high school. And so that's when we watched it. And then he had me watch Rushmore, and I was like, that's not very good. And then he had me watch Life Aquatic, and I was like, I really don't like that. For me, Wes Anderson was a little bit different. And I feel like Wes Anderson found his stride with Moonrise and with Grand Budapest. And I feel like he got too into himself with Isle of Dogs and French Dispatch. And I feel like now I'm curious to see where he's going to go from here, because I do think that Wes has a way of making like two movies at a time. Throw out Bottle Rocket, because that was the first movie. He did Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums, which similar in, you know, I know like you're saying they're different because it's ensemble, whatever. But
tonally, they're still very similar.
Tonally, they're similar. And then Darjeeling and Life Aquatic were definitely way different. Like those were weirder movies.
Yeah.
And then he did Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I think you can just kind of throw that out on its own. And then it was Moonrise and Grand Budapest, which were style, but like what still had like a really easy to follow story with quirky characters. Isle of Dogs, I don't know what I was watching. And then you get into French Dispatch, and French Dispatch feels like he's still in his head like he was with Isle of Dogs. I like the French Dispatch. I don't love the French Dispatch, but I just think like I'm curious to see where is he going to go from here? What's going to be the next evolution of Wes Anderson?
Yeah, it's a question that'll hang on to us until he releases the next movie, but it still feels like if he just finds this spark and like this home that he had with like the Royal Tenenbaums, we can get another phenomenal film out of him.
Yep. I agree. It'll happen again. I mean, I'm not convinced at all. I mean, I know you love French Dispatch. To me, it didn't have that same pacing that this movie has or something like that. So.
Yeah, I can understand that.
All right. Anyway, so that's it for this week. We will be back next week. John, I am actually good to do Thursday if you want to do Thursday next week.
Sounds good.
We'll talk about it. You know, we'll figure it out. But I thought I wasn't going to be available, but now I am. Next week, we're going to be talking about Blair Witch Project from 1999 and Taxi Driver from 1976. That's going to be a heavy episode. That is not going to be light. So if you're into comedies, don't watch that week because that's going to be something. Should be a lot of fun. That'll be getting into our number 33s. Remember, if you're interested, you want to talk movies, you want to just have that conversation going, John and I are over in the Discord. $1 patrons, you can just come on over, become a patron. Patreon.com/survivorspecialist. You get access to the Discord. You can have conversation with anything. You just want to have access to the $5, $10, and $20 patron stuff, which you're not going to care about if you don't watch Survivor anyway. So that's all that being said. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with Blair Witch Project and Taxi Driver.